With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today, Professor Denis Lacorne. He's Director of Research at Sciences Po in Paris, where he specializes in the political history of the United States. He joined Sciences Po's Center for International Studies and Research, well known by its French acronym CERI, in 1982. A frequent commentator on American politics in the French press and on French television, his books include With Us or Against Us, Studies in Global Anti-Americanism, and Language, Nation, and State, Identity, Politics, and a Multilingual Age, both written with the late distinguished historian Tony Judd. Of course, he's also the author of our book under consideration today, Religion in America, a Political History. Professor Lacorne's research examines American multiculturalism, religion and secularism, U.S. elections and foreign policy, and urban violence and ethnic identities in the United States. He has been a visiting professor at universities in Europe, Asia, and the United States, including Stanford, UC Berkeley, and Columbia. He earned his PhD in political science from Yale University, not far from here. Today he'll be talking about the themes he lays out in this book, Religion in America. So please join me in welcoming Professor Denis Lacorne.
Thank you so much for your welcome. And it's always a pleasure for me to come back here. It's the second time I give a talk here. And it's always wonderful to have as host my friend Peter Skerry and Wolf, of course. And I would love to engage in discussion with them. And last time we met was in Britain, but on a very different topic, which was polarization in America. Well, not, we met on polarization in American politics. And, of course, coming from France back to the United States, and I do that quite often, actually, maybe about twice a year or three times a year, but coming from a secular culture, it's always a surprise to me to see how important is the place of religion in politics. And I was there last summer, and there was much talk about Governor Perry's Day of Prayer, the response, where he said, among many other things, declared his love for the living Christ, which of course would make a Christian, or for that matter a Catholic, or a non-Christian, quite uncomfortable. But that's part of politics, or at least Southern politics in the United States. And so as a French political scientist who's written on the origin of the American Republic and its affinities with the French Republican ideas, that was my first book, was called The Invention of the American Republic. I've also written an article which was called The Trade in Republican Ideas, The Transatlantic Trade in Republican Ideas. So I've always been interested in interaction between the two societies. And the challenge coming from Europe, from France, is to explain a political tradition that invites politicians to talk very openly about their faith and to defend religious ideas or religious symbols in the public space. And on the other hand, another tradition, which is still very much alive, which is that of separation of church and state, that insists on the necessity to preserve at least elements of that other tradition and the idea that state or government ought to be neutral and ought not to mingle with, or there should be no entanglement between politics and religion. So how to reconcile those opposite or competing trends, if you wish. And the book is an attempt to do that. And so you have to understand that for me what matters is not so much religion in itself, but religion as it is, or the users, I should say, of religion by historians, intellectuals, and politicians, particularly those who are reflecting on the American national identity. And, of course, national identities are never easy to define, and I often like to refer to the great historian John Muirin, who said, well, what's unique about the American experience is that you built the constitutional walls, the constitutional roof, before the national walls. And that's a rather unique experience. It took over a century and a civil war to solidify the nation walls, but the constitutional roof is still there, unchanged, which also is unique. I mean, in France, we have we are the fifth constitution. So there's that peculiar American phenomenon. And the argument is then the following. From a European perspective, I claim that if I look at early narratives of identity building in the United States, of identity formation in the United States, basically I see two competing narratives. One that centers on, we could call it the creation story, if you wish, of a secular republic. And the other, it's another creation story, which develops a little later, the creation story of a republic that's based on Neo-Puritan ideas and a romantic imagination. And I'll explain what I mean by that. But this other story, which I call Neo-Puritan, basically denies the secular origin or the secular nature of the American government and give tremendous importance to the Pilgrims and the Puritans. So let me start with the first narrative. Now, if you look at the way in Europe, Enlightenment, not just France, but also Britain and the Scottish Enlightenment, but the way Enlightenment philosophers considered Puritan experience, they are, in the 18th century, extremely critical of Puritanism in general. Read Locke on the murder of Michel Servet, and also on New England Puritans. And here I give a number of examples, but for instance, Voltaire writes in the Examen de Milord Bolingbroke, 1736, denounces the stupidity of fanaticism, I cite him, and of all Christian millenarians, called the Christicon, who accept literally the Book of Revelation and make, quote, the demented prediction that a new Jerusalem would descend upon the earth. And the result was that Europe was drowned in an ocean of blood. So it's a very pessimistic view of the danger of religion in general and the most excessive form of religiosity. And I could multiply, and I do multiply the examples in the book, but Abbé Raynal, for instance, wrote A History of the Two Indies, which is a history of the colonization of North and South America, is also extremely critical of the Puritans of New England, and find them particularly scandalous because he claims that at first they were helped survive thanks to local American Indians, and then a couple of years later, he has in mind is the massacre that was organized by Captain Lovewell in New England, they murder peaceful American Indians. So how is that possible? And Raynal, who has a kind of modern leftist language, but we're talking the 18th century, says the following. Were you civilized men? He says, talking to American Puritans in a rhetorical way, and quote, were you Christians? No, you were monsters of extermination. And then he compares the Puritans to the conquistador and finds an interesting similarity between two very different type of settlers. And many other visitors like La Rochefoucauld-Liancourt, like Chateaubriand, who will come to the United States, will, having read Voltaire, having read L'Abbé Raynal, will look for that and will denounce, for instance, Chateaubriand is very harsh about the Puritans who were too willing, I quote him, to immolate their brothers for the love of heaven, and so on and so forth. And yet, in all of that, what's interesting is that there's one religion that fascinates the French Enlightenment, and that's Quakerism. Read Voltaire's Lettres Philosophiques. He loves the Quakers, but probably not for reasons that the one you may anticipate. He loved the Quakers because he sees there the opposite of the Catholic Church, a religion for a non-religious age, a religion where you have no confession, communion, and so it's the kind of utopian religion that he'd like to have in Europe, which we don't really have in Europe except in Britain at the time and Pennsylvania. And he praises Penn for being the leader of a, quote, government without priests. So that's part of the fascination at the time. And again, Chateaubriand and others will come. The first thing they'll do when they go to Philadelphia is try to talk to Quakers and confirm or not Voltaire's idea. And in fact, a number of them will be quite disappointed by what they see of Quakerism. What's interesting also at the time, and I give some importance to that, is the dialogue between Desmonniers, who is the editor-in-chief of it's a post-Diderot encyclopedia, l'encyclopédie méthodique. It starts with 8 or 12 volumes, and then it will have 150. But that's the new encyclopedia after Diderot. And Desmonniers is a lawyer by training. He's the secretary of Monsieur He's the brother of Louis XVI, a very influential politician. And he publishes in this encyclopedia, which is published between 1784 and 1788, right before the French Revolution, there are 14 articles dedicated to the United States. One is États-Unis and one per state, and they examine very closely, in great details, what happens in this and that state. And in the first volume, in the volume États-Unis, which comes out in 1786, there is a long section on Jefferson's bill for establishing religious freedom, which is translated the year of its passage in the Virginia legislature, and fully translated, discussed as an example of what Americans do and that we may want to do and which we will do in France. This is 3 years before the French Revolution. This fascination for this bill for establishing religious freedom, which, as you know, disestablish the Anglican Church and abolish all religious oaths of allegiance and so on and so forth. The French are interested in a separation of church and state which is invented by Americans. Now, I could multiply the examples, not just the French. You know the work of Tom Paine, but for instance, there's a Crito written by James Berg, which is a fascinating little book, which is a utopian work written for the people of Britain of the 20th century. And it's written in 1767. And in that book, James Berg, who's a radical Whig, writes, among other things, it's also why you write a utopian work is to avoid criticism. If you want to criticize the monarchy today, you place your city sometimes somewhere in the 20th century. And he recommends, he dreams of a separation of church and state in Britain, and writes about the necessity to build, that's his advice to the people of Britain of the 20th century, build an impenetrable wall of separation between things sacred and civil. And Daniel Griesbach has argued that Crito was owned, in fact, by Jefferson. He probably read that sentence, and that tremendously influenced him with the famous letter to the Baptist community of Denbury. So let me briefly consider the second neo-Puritan narrative of American identity. Now, here you have to place yourself in the first third of the 19th century. The French Revolution has failed with the terror. The Enlightenment is being criticized, reason is being questioned, and it's a time when the romantic imagination in Germany, but not just Germany, in Britain and France and the United States, puts a lot of weight on emotion, religion, tradition, emotional religion, and a distant past, medieval or pre-medieval, and it's in that context that all the Europeans will fantasize about the Gauls, the Saxons, the Saxon liberty in Germany, so on and so forth. And it's at this point that a new historiographic concept becomes key, it seems to me, throughout Europe and in the United States, is that of the character of a nation, or the Volksgeist, Schlegel brothers will say, trying to find the origin of a nation in a people, rooted like a plant, an organism rooted in an ancient people that determines the future. And of course, the German will fantasize about the Germanic tribe in the woods of Germany, described by Tacitus. The Saxon will be praised in Britain over the Normans, and so on and so forth. A good example from Tocqueville, for instance, which illustrates that new historiography. In chapter 2 of Democracy in America, which is about the point of departure of the American democracy, here's what it says, quote, it talks about the character of a nation, and it says, well, it is contained in its origin, quote, in a manner of speaking, the whole man already lies swaddled in its cradle. That's an example of this new. And, of course, it's not by chance that this imagination is so prevalent in the United States. First of all, you have, of course, New England historians have always praised the importance of the Pilgrims and the Puritans, but they have a minor impact until other historians like George Bancroft will try to nationalize the New England narrative, make it the narrative to explain the future of America. And Bancroft is a very important author. He publishes 10-volume The History of the United States, but volume 1 is published in 1834, 1 year before Tocqueville's first volume, Democracy in America, 1837. And in fact, I think there's a lot of cross-fertilization between the two. And never forget that Bancroft is that boy genius who graduated from Harvard at 14, went to Germany
between 1818 and 1822, studied with Schleiermacher theology. He studied with Beckler, who's a specialist in Tacitus. He studied history with Heer, a specialist, a student of Herder. He studied with Planck on church history and so on. And he comes back with this idea, you know, let's define, where's the spirit of the nation? Let's define modern democracy according to that spirit or that Volksgeist, but he doesn't use the term, it says character of the nation. And in the United States, if you bracket out American Indians, if you bracket out the first settlers who came to Virginia, and Bancroft is aware of that, so he's Tocqueville, but those did not have high motivations. They were there to make money, and that's it. So if you bracket out those two, you're left with the oldest reputable, virtuous ancestors, and they happen to be the Pilgrims and the Puritans. And I would argue that Bancroft does for America what Tacitus has done for the Germans. He would rehabilitate the Pilgrims, mocked and denigrated by Enlightenment philosophers. In fact, the first volume of Bancroft's History of the United States marks the triumph of this New England historiography. And he talks, there's a cult of ancestors, of course, that developed that point. And there are extraordinary passages in Bancroft's first volume where he talks, quote, of the sublimity of the Pilgrims at Plymouth. And the same kind of reasoning you find, perhaps a little more subtle, but you still find it with Tocqueville in the chapter 2, the famous chapter 2 on the origin of the American democracy, where he praises also the Puritan experience, and very much like Bancroft, claims that the climax of that wonderful experience took place in the cabin of the Mayflower, where true democracy, even constitutional democracy, was invented. That's what he says, that's what Bancroft says as well. Tocqueville goes even further. In a note that was recently rediscovered, he compares the Mayflower Compact to a genuine social contract in the lines dreamt by Rousseau. And of course, modern historians have challenged that reading of history and pointed the fact that the Mayflower Compact may have been an act or circumstance to prevent a near mutiny aboard the Mayflower, so it's not this grand republic invented there. But that's New England historiography for you. Now to finish my presentation, I'd like to look at today, 20th century, 21st century, and what I would call the revival or the modernization of those two narratives today. And I'll give you a few examples. Revival of the secular narrative first, and then revival of the neo-Puritan romantic narrative. Now, in the best place, I think, to find this revival of the secular narrative is to look at legal cases. And, of course, the most significant for me is the famous Everson decision in 1947, where Thomas Jefferson is rediscovered by Justice Black, and cited. I mean, that decision ends with a famous quote. The First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be high and impregnable. We would not accept the slightest breach. End quote. Which, in fact, may contradict the content of the decision, but that's another point. And Black's rediscovery of Jefferson is interesting because, you know, who would read Jefferson's letter to the Baptist community of Danbury in 1947? Why care about that? And one reason is that in the case law that's invoked by Justice Black, there are not too many cases on religious liberty or establishment at the time. And by the way, Everson is also the decision that through the doctrine of incorporation applies the establishment clause to the states. So it's a very late decision. But in the case law that he considers, there's an earlier decision, the Reynolds decision of 1879, which is about a law that criminalizes polygamy. The Mormon, at the time the Mormons are part of a territory, it's not yet a state. And Justice Waite, who wrote that opinion, Chief Justice Waite in 1879, in fact, has that case, Reynolds, has a wonderful annex, the full text of Jefferson's bill for religious freedom, Madison's documents, Jefferson's letter to the Baptists of Danbury. And the question is why those justices are so interested in history and in documents that have been forgotten. And the response to the case of Justice Waite, which is kind of fascinating, is just because he lived in Washington next to someone who was George Bancroft, and who fed him with document about the context of the writing of the First Amendment. Now, today, I would still argue that the true guardians of the wall separation are progressive justices of the Supreme Court. People like Souter, for instance, or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or Breyer, perhaps. And what is the separatist line? I mean, lawyers like to talk about separationist. I prefer separatist, anti-separatist, and there's a third category, which we may talk about, the accommodationist. That's a kind of in-between category. But if you take separatists like Justice Souter, there's a famous case, McCreary County versus ACLU. Well, there it's about a posting of the Ten Commandments on the wall of courthouses in Kentucky, and for him that violates the Establishment Clause. So the reasoning here is a religious display, whatever its nature, it could be a nativity scene, it could be a cross, it could be tablets for the Ten Commandments, cannot be permitted, cannot be tolerated in the public space if it sends, I cite him, who in fact cites O'Connor in an earlier decision, if it sends the message to, quote, non-adherents, that they are outsiders, not full member of the political community. And in the same decision, Souter insists that the First Amendment mandates governmental neutrality between religion, and between religion and non-religion. An interesting recognition of the place of atheism in our society as well. So, in other words, there's no preferred religion in the United States. The citizenship or the political community is really perceived as all-inclusive. And which means that every religion, even the most pagan, the less Christian religion imaginable, there's a wonderful case on a Santeria church in Florida. It's called the Church of the Lukumu Babalu Ai, where the decision of the court is to tolerate the animal sacrifices that are performed in that church, even though they're cruel and even though they violate a local ordinance, because that's part of the rite, and we have to respect that peculiar religion where you eat up chicken necks and the chickens are alive when you do that. That's you tolerate every possible religion and non-religion. Now, lastly, concerning the modernization of the new Puritan narrative, let me give you three possible examples in the court system, in political science, and in politics today. In the court system, there are a number of justices that believe or actually convinced that the creation story of the Republic is really a biblical thing. That in fact the United States is always was a Christian nation, and that the founding fathers were deeply Christian, not deists or agnostic. And here's a typical quote from Rehnquist in a 1963 decision. I quote him. It's an interesting way of writing history where an historian would not do it, I would say. Quote, the fact that the founding fathers believed devotedly, so I repeat, devotedly, that there was a God and the rights of man were rooted in him is clearly evidenced in their writings from the Mayflower Compact to the Constitution itself. Now, in that reasoning, you have this kind of collapsing of two very different historical epochs in a strange way, but which is a way of saying that minimizing the impact of the founding fathers and exaggerating that of the Puritans. And in fact, the same justice and many others will never understand that the creator that exists in the Declaration of Independence is not, as Walter Burns put it in a lovely little book called Making Patriots, the creator is not the jealous God of the Old Testament. The creator is an architect of the universe, Voltairean God. He gives rights and then he disappears. Who defines the rights? Who expends the rights? Who rules? It's the people. It's the people's sovereignty. It's not that he doesn't punish, doesn't condemn. It's a particular kind of deist institution. Remember also that Jefferson wrote the famous Jefferson Bible, which on his spare time when he was elected president, and that Jefferson Bible takes away, which is a cut and paste, it takes the Gospels, cuts and paste, and remove every single reference to miracles and to the resurrection. It ends, in fact, the following way, quote, and Joseph rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed. Period. That's the end of the Jefferson Bible. Which doesn't mean that Jefferson was anti-religious. That's another point. I mean, he defended Baptists in Virginia against the Anglicans. He was elected thanks to small churches against the Federalists who represented the more established churches. So again, one should not be confused to be a secular person or even not to believe in God or to mock the Gospels doesn't mean that you're necessarily anti-religious. And there are lots of speeches by Jefferson that sound terribly religious. And never forget that Lincoln, probably the least religious of all American presidents, had a wonderful religious rhetoric that he used in many, many circumstances. Now, in political science, just in passing, how much time do you still give me? Or should I... 5 minutes, or should I stop?
It's up to you. We can try to wrap up.
In political science, very clearly, quickly, one example, but there are several, would be of the late Professor Huntington's book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. And I think there's a lineage, a connection with what I call the Neo-Puritan paradigm, even though he modernizes it too, through via Myrdal and the notion of the American creed. But his American creed is again a strange collapse of Puritan values together with Republican values, and even forges the interesting concept, no one else has done it to my knowledge, of the founding settlers, to put together founding fathers and the Puritans. So it's a kind of reconciliation of the two. But he still says in that book, quote, religion has been and still is central, perhaps the central element of American identity. And with the implications that Hispanics are probably cannot truly be assimilated because they do not believe in the American creed, which is problematic, and I think Professor Huntington has forgotten how difficult and how long it took for Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics to assimilate in the mainstream, and hence the importance, I think, the chapter that I have on the Bible wars in the United States. I think we've forgotten how violent, how disruptive, how vicious were the Bible wars, and that's a section of the book. And last example, well, today in politics, you have it in the current primary debate. There are clearly some candidates that like the neo-Puritan narrative and even overdo it. The best example of Herman Cain's recent speech at the Values Voters Summit, where he kept talking about the city on the hill, and he was no longer was on the hill, was on the side of the hill, but he was here to put it back on the top of the hill, and so on. It's part of that neo-romantic, neo-Puritan imagination, which you don't have with Obama. President Obama, for instance, is very much aware of religious issues, but he identifies more with the secular narrative, and in his speeches you never find a reference to the New Jerusalem or the city on the hill, which were so much favored by Reagan and Bush father and Bush son. Now, with the debate, Perry exemplifies as well, I think, this neo-Puritan paradigm of Bachman, both convinced that we have a Christian government built on Christian principles, or even in Washington, D.C., there's this, I think Jeff Rosen has written an interesting article on the National Center for Constitutional Studies, which is a Christian rights seminar that's run in Washington and attended by elected members of the Congress and their staff, and which is dedicated to demonstrate that the Christian nature of the American government. Now, it's worth, if you have the time to waste, or maybe not, is to read William Clarence Kauser's 5,000-year leap, 28 great ideas that changed the world. It's like simplistic rewriting of Bancroft, with even an advocacy of a return to Saxon liberties and the superiority of Anglo-Saxon thought. Okay, should I could in 2 minutes conclude with some reference to France, or take the questions right now? And
why don't we turn to questions?
Okay,
I'm certain that will come up in the questions as well.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Maybe last point that I wanted to make is that the new Puritan narrative, why is it so prevalent today? And I think it's not just because we have primaries today, it's because we have the Southern strategy of the Republican Party that has changed the nature of the Republican Party and necessarily has given conservative evangelicals a very prominent place in that party. There are many other variants of evangelicals who can be social justice that are not necessarily conservative. So again, there one should not be too simplistic either. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.